Labricks is
just Labricks.com.
Labricks.com. And yeah. There is a website for your book as well.
Yes, slimsaneandsexy.com.
Check it out. It's a great book. This is a whole new world for you. You can read that book. It's got a lot of information. And
in fact, one of the things in the book someone can go right to is the questionnaire.
So we have been speaking with Dr. Erin Lohman, naturopathic physician about low libido in women, co-author of the book Slim, Sane, and Sexy. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Ellen Goldsmith, licensed acupuncturist, your host. Tune in next month on December 10th when I'll be speaking with Dr. Peter Levine on trauma and memory. And be sure to tune in next week to hear Dr. David Naiman on Health Watch. Thank you.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Cascade Media Convergence, a regional gathering of community-based media makers sharing space and skills to build solidarity on November 14th and 15th on the Portland State University campus. There will be skill shares, issue-based strategy sessions, regional breakouts and workshops, as well as movie screenings and a keynote presentation, editors of Octavia's Brood, science fiction stories from social justice movements. Again, that's the Cascade Media Convergence, November 14th and 15th, on the Portland State University campus in downtown Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In these programs, we present new information or new insights about old and new health issues. We consider everything from community efforts to improve and extend health care to all people, to environmental issues that threaten us all, and to discussions with those individuals and their ideas that can move us forward in the search for health. My guests today are Marge Stevens and Mike Beilstein. They've both gone with Pastors for Peace to Cuba on a number of the annual visits taking humanitarian aid. So welcome, Marge and Mike.
Thanks, Roberta.
It's nice to be here.
Let's talk first about your involvement. Now, I know that this project has been going on since 1992, and I understand from the website that there have been 26 separate trips. So tell me about your involvement, and then we'll talk about the group and the relationship to medicine and medical education. Mike, do you want to start off? How long have you been going?
Thanks, Roberta. I first found out about Pastors for Peace in 1996. They'd been operating for several years before that, but some friends from Albany, the Hemmingsons, went to Cuba with the Pastors for Peace caravan, and we did a major effort of organizing aid. That year we were collecting mostly computers that were going to be used as terminals in a medical information system in Cuba. I got involved that year, and then I worked with Pastors for Peace every year since that to organize their caravan to Cuba, but I wasn't able to travel myself until the year 2006. So for about 10 years I wanted to go, but just with family and work obligations couldn't get away. So I've been going to Cuba every year since 2006. This year was the 10th time I've gone, and it's been nice to have that long experience over 10 years to, you know, seeing Cuba each year and seeing the changes, because it's a very rapid changes going on there. In general, the economy is improving. People are better off. And of course, there are individuals there that I only see once a year when I go to Cuba. So it's nice to get back and see those old friends again.
And usually the trip is 2 weeks or 3 weeks?
We spend a week to 10 days, maybe I think the longest 11 days in Cuba. But I'm traveling for a month when I leave, because we go on a caravan through the United States. We'll stop at maybe 10 cities. Each city have an event. As we travel to McAllen, Texas, and other people from around the country will be coming on different routes and the kind of following the same pattern. You know, each city have an event and then pick up aid, go to the next city, and so on. Then we all converge at McAllen, Texas. We're there for a few days for training and orientation, and then cross the border into Mexico with the aid, and then from Mexico to Cuba.
Well, Marge, tell us about your experience.
Yeah, Mike invited me, and I was able to go in 2013 for the first time, and then I went again this year in 2015. The first year I went with Pastors for Peace, we traveled to the far eastern end of the island, to Santiago, and at that location we visited some of the facilities that are used there for medical education, went to a graduation class in the Santiago area. And then in 2015, again, we went and stayed in the Havana area. And in that Havana area was the main campus of the School for the Latin American Studies of Medicine. We got to see their facilities, and we also attended a graduating class at the Karl Marx Auditorium, where there was a group graduating from the school. So Pastors for Peace does include a lot of focus on the medical school and that aspect, but it also has a broader scope too, in that we learn about various social programs that are going on and cultural events and all. So it's a broad scope of information as we travel. I'll also mention that when I went in 2013, I was able to experience the medical system myself because I got really sick and had to go into an emergency clinic and be treated. So I have that viewpoint as well.
And the treatment?
The treatment was good. It's something I could talk about in detail, but I had good treatment and I recovered well.
That seems to be the story that most people who travel to almost any country in the world outside the U.S., they have good treatment and low cost. That's wonderful. Well, Pastors for Peace. Now, you all aren't all pastors. In fact, neither of you. I know you're both involved with local churches, different ones, but not pastors. So who is the group that is behind this, and how widely do they recruit? And I'm wondering how many people normally go with you on these adventures and offer aid, and what kind of aid and where it comes from. But okay, let's start with the name of the group.
I'll give a little history of Pastors for Peace. It was founded by Lucius Walker, who was a Baptist minister. I think he was actually in Chicago at the time, although they relocated. The organization now is in New York City. Lucius Walker was a civil rights organizer, and in the 80s he became concerned about Nicaragua, you know, at the time of the Contra War. He was visiting in Nicaragua with some kind of fact-finding mission with his parent organization, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organizing, IFCO. It's hard to remember exactly what that is, but he was visiting in Nicaragua, and he was actually shot while he was on a ferry going across the river, and they were attacked by Contras. Some people on the ferry were killed. He was shot. He was wounded and was in a hospital in Nicaragua, where he met with another Presbyterian minister, stopped in to see him, an American, and the two of them were kind of puzzled by this, that the bullet that shot Lucius Walker was actually paid for by American taxpayers. So they thought, well, we need to do something to organize about this to support the people of Nicaragua. And so the first aid caravan, I think, was in 88, and this was an aid caravan to Nicaragua, which at the time was also under an embargo or a blockade by the United States government. They organized their first aid caravan in 88, and they continued to do Latin American aid caravans after that. In 92, they were invited to come to Cuba, and that was the first time that they did an aid caravan to Cuba.
Who invited them? Do you know?
The host for Pastors for Peace in Cuba has always been the Cuban Council of Churches, and especially there's an organization called the Martin Luther King Peace Center in Havana that's associated with the Ebenezer Baptist Church. But it's basically the Cuban Council of Churches. The leader of the Martin Luther King Peace Center and the pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church is Raul Suarez, a Baptist minister, and he's also a member of the National Assembly, the Parliament of Cuba. So he's somewhat of a prominent figure, and he's, you know, one of the main people responsible for creating the rapprochement between the government and the Protestant churches in Cuba. I'm sure initially after the revolution there was a very hostile relationship between the churches and the government, but then over time, especially through the work of people like Raul Suarez, there's been an alignment of the goals of the churches and that of the government, so that the Protestant churches especially have a very good working relationship with the Cuban government, and they see their role as being part of the socialist process of providing good quality of life to people of Cuba.
Social services, humanitarian kinds of things.
That's correct. So since 92, the Pastors for Peace has done an aid caravan to Cuba, and they've generally concentrated on medical aid. And that's part of the reason for that is because of the blockade, Cubans don't have access to medicine or medical equipment from the United States. You know, so pharmaceuticals that are licensed by United States companies are manufactured by U.S. pharmaceutical companies. And now almost everything is, you know, you might have had a lot of independent pharmaceutical companies in Europe, like in Switzerland or England. But the thing is that there have been so many mergers and consolidation of that industry. Bayer is a German company, but since they have operations in the United States, then you can't buy Bayer aspirin in Cuba.
Oh my goodness. And what we know about the pharmaceutical companies, they love to rake in money.
If they do business in Cuba, they can't do business in the United States.
Wow, that would hurt.
And so you've got a market of Cuba's poor to start with, and that's only 3% of the size of the United States in population. Mm-hmm. It's a very small market there, and you're not going to give up a giant market in the United States to be able to do business in Cuba.
No, no.
I was going to answer your question, Bobby, about who it is that travels with Pastors for Peace caravan to Cuba. And there are some pastors who travel, actually, with the caravan. There was a woman from Oregon, from Ashland this year, who's a pastor of, I think, a congregational church who was traveling. And there was also a pastor, a Baptist pastor from Florida, who came on the trip. A lot of the people who go may be affiliated with churches or may not, but they have this social justice ethic that interests them and makes them want to participate in the experience there.
So the name Pastors for Peace is catchy and rememberable. IFCO was an acronym and trips the tongue not so well. The name Pastors for Peace is very, very familiar. How many people go with you, or does it vary from year to year a lot?
It varies from year to year. I think that like the largest caravans have been over 300 people. And that was in the early 90s, 93, 94. When I started going in 2006, I think there were it's like 150 people on that caravan. But it's been dwindling since then. This last year, I think we had about 50. The year before that, it was even smaller. It's not the big numbers, you know, the hundreds that like they had when they first started, but it's a lot of dedicated people who will be going every year.
And you go along with the load of materials. How do you transport these materials around Cuba to the appropriate places, or does the Council of Churches in Cuba take over that end of it?
Well, the materials are gathered as the caravans move through the country and stop, as Mike mentioned earlier, at the various cities along the way. And they're traveling in donated old school buses that are all painted up with nice painting on the sides that have to do with the Pastors for Peace theme. Once all these school buses converge in McAllen, Texas, that aid is unloaded there at a large Lutheran church that has a big gym. And then it's all sorted, packaged, manifested, and loaded onto a big semi truck. And then also there's often donations of actual vehicles themselves. So school buses are donated, trucks, various vehicles. Once all the aid and all the vehicles are prepared and ready, they get driven down through Reynosa, Mexico to Tampico, which is a port of Mexico. And at that point, they get loaded onto a ship and then taken to Cuba. And at that point, the pastors and the material go separate routes. So the pastors arrive and do their cultural events, and then later on, the aid arrives and is received and distributed through that Council of Churches group.
Very interesting. So it's quite well organized. At that end, it takes a lot of planning at both ends, really, as it moves along.
Yeah, the Pastors for Peace puts out on their website information about what materials are being solicited and how to package them, how to label them as they're packaged, because they have to go through customs, they have to pass through the Mexican border. Yeah, there's a certain sort of bureaucracy or, you know, important paper trail that has to happen with it.
As with any travelers who go out of country, you have to keep your little card. Well, that's one big part of this. I'd like to talk about the medical school and the medical education, because it provides doctors for much of Latin America, as I understand it, and also for the United States. And before I go on, I just want to remind listeners that I'm talking to Marge Stevens and Mike Beilstein about their recent trip, and that was, I think, July with Pastors for Peace to Cuba, and at a very interesting time. Maybe we'll get to talk about that too. Interesting time because some improvements in relationships are beginning to happen. Let's talk about the school first, the medical school.
I'd like to tell you the history of the medical school. This is a Latin American school of medicine. The Spanish acronym is ELAM, E-L-A-M. This was founded in 1999, and if you might remember, 98, there was major hurricanes. Hurricane Mitch especially hit Nicaragua and Guatemala and Honduras. Anyway, and the Cubans, for a long time, it's a national practice that they provide physicians, for disaster relief. And so any time there's a big earthquake or a storm or flood or something, there'll be Cuban doctors will be the first ones there. You know, they probably do more total medical aid work than the whole World Health Organization. This has been going on for quite a while. And so Cuba was sending doctors to Latin America after the hurricanes as part of the relief program. However, they were going in areas where people had never seen a doctor before. And so then after the hurricane relief was over, the Cubans were going to bring the doctors back. But the people there said, no, leave the doctors here. We need doctors. So the Cuban government made this decision, Fidel Castro was in charge, so you say he made the decision, that rather than sending doctors, Cuban doctors permanently to places in Latin America, what they should do is bring those Latin Americans to Cuba and train them to be doctors. So following the hurricane in 98, then in 99 was the founding of the Latin American School of Medicine. And the program was to admit 1,500 students a year throughout Latin America with the idea that they would be provided free medical education, medical school, and upon graduating, they would go back to their home countries with no commitment to the Cuban government, but with the idea that they would provide service in their home communities. And that's pretty much how the program has operated since then. So 1,500 a year. I think in about 2002 was the first year at the request of some U.S. congressmen that they started admitting students from the United States as well, because some congressmen visiting in Cuba learned about the school. They commented, well, we hardly have any physicians in my congressional district. So they really concentrated. It was primarily black students admitted from the United States, and then Latinos, people from underserved medical areas in the United States are admitted. So they admit now somewhere between 10 and 20 U.S. citizens per year out of their total 1,500 per year.
1,500 is a lot. Medical schools often have a few hundred. That's big.
The way this school operates, they do their first 2 years of academic training in Havana at a single campus. Their further training after the first 2 years, when it becomes more practical and less academic, then they go out to hospitals throughout the island. For security reasons, they keep all the U.S. citizens who are students there at one hospital in Havana, so like if the United States demands that they be evacuated immediately or something, then they've got them in one location, close to airport.
They might not be very popular in some areas of Cuba. Would that be true?
I see hardly any anti-American sentiment. People don't like the blockade. They resent that the United States has the base in Guantanamo. Marge maybe has some other opinion on this, but I generally don't see any anti-American sentiment.
That's very interesting.
This year on our travels, I got to stay in the same room with a woman from New York City whose daughter has attended and graduated from this Latin American School of Medicine in Cuba. And she told me that while her daughter was studying medicine there in Cuba, part of what she did was she stayed with a family, a Cuban family. It was her lodging while she was there. And she became very close with this family. And when we arrived in Havana, that family came to meet up with this couple who are the parents of the student there. And so there's quite a connection that develops between the people who are hosting the students and the students who are visiting from the United States to study medicine.
It's almost like a people-to-people program in a sense, because once the peoples get to know each other, things do tend to improve at the country level as well. I looked up the information about IFCO just a little bit ago, and it looks to me like 12 semesters of study in their curriculum, starting with basic sciences and so forth, and of course the really important part, the clinical part, the internship and practical things that you mentioned, and that would be at the latter part of the program, the students would go out into the smaller communities or other hospitals and get their training, as any residency program does.
That's right. And even for some students who are not Spanish speakers, they have an introductory year where they're taught Spanish, and particularly medical Spanish, scientific Spanish. Because in addition to students from the United States, students come from Caribbean islands where they might not speak Spanish. They come from Asia. They come from Africa. Brazil, the program has expanded to such a great extent that a lot of students come in needing to learn Spanish. Something else that's pretty important, I think, is that this is provided at no charge to the students. Mm-hmm. So this is a complete scholarship program provided by the Cuban government, and it pays not only for the tuition for the education, but also for the room, the board, the books, and they get a stipend to live on. It's a very generous program that the Cuban government offers, and it could be thought of as sort of their foreign aid program in a way?
It would be. Yeah. And for the American ones, the IFCO, as I understand, provides some scholarship money as well and helps in that selection process. Is that right?
Yeah, IFCO, Pastors for Peace, is the kind of the recruiting agency for the medical school in the United States. So nobody goes from the United States except through IFCO. IFCO screens people, and there's some basic academic requirements. So people have to have finished a university level physics and chemistry course. U.S. medical schools, you know, you have to have a 4.0 GPA and all sorts of community service. And, you know, they're looking for the very elite for U.S. medical schools. But actually, the people who are most academically talented don't necessarily make the best doctors. I would agree that being a physician is an intellectually challenging profession, but it's not like you don't have to be the smartest guy on the block to be a good doctor. You have to have compassion, you have to have a sense of service. So what they're looking for in the recruitment is people who do have that commitment to doing community service through the practice of medicine. That's the type of person they want.
And in this country, the main shortage is for the primary care physician. Pay is a little bit less than for the specialist.
And in addition to that, there are people coming into the program who have suffered trauma in their life. They're coming from nations, maybe in Africa, maybe other parts of the world, where they've experienced some pretty difficult situations in their lives as they've been growing up in war areas and traumatic situations where they're living. And so part of the introduction to the school, too, is it includes counseling and assistance for people who are not necessarily physically injured, but maybe carry scars from their experiences that they've had. I see this program, in addition to training doctors to go back home to their countries to treat people, it's almost to treat the country itself by taking some of these really traumatized people from difficult situations and giving them some time for healing, not only physically, but psychologically, spiritually as well. To me, that was something I learned this year that was a very important aspect of the program.
I'd like to just talk about the medical system in Cuba, which is also reflected in the medical school. That, for one thing, they've got more doctors than we do here. They have about twice as many doctors. I think it's 27 per 10,000 in the United States, and it's 57 per 10,000 in Cuba. And their model of providing health care is community-based. So a doctor in Cuba, a general practitioner, family physician in Cuba, will be operating within a neighborhood that maybe covers 100, 200 families. And that's his primary responsibility, so that, you know, the idea of making house calls is expected. Even when you're not sick, you can expect a visit from the doctor. There's a sense of what are the medical needs of the community, how many people have diabetes or elevated blood pressure. And so they keep track of these statistics. What are the medical needs in our community? Then beyond the primary care physicians. Now, they do have what they call polyclinics, and then they have the hospital, so they have these three levels. Concept of community-based medicine, where, you know, you're responsible for the health care of a community, not seeing individual patients, is how the health care is taught in medical school. So people are trained to be primary care physicians, and they're taught to be community physicians. So in the United States, we have some of that. I think the closest model for that community-based medicine is the federally funded health centers, like we have one in Benton County.
We didn't get to the changes that are going on in Cuban-American relationship. Are they really opening up the blockade, or is it just really a peeking under the covers at this point, do you think?
There's no end to the U.S. economic harassment of Cuba. The blockade is continuing still under the Torricelli Law and the Helms-Burton Laws. These were laws passed in 95 and 96. There was a sense of excitement, I think, about the reestablishing diplomatic relations. People are excited about these changing relations with the U.S., but the economic warfare against Cuba is, as far as we know, is just going on as it always had. The goal is still regime change in Cuba, to end socialism, to reintroduce, you know, corrupt politics. But I'm not saying that there wasn't progress.
You all who go with Pastors for Peace have been allowed to get through somehow. This diplomatic recognition, would this possibly mean that in the next year you could go from the United States if you wish? Sounds like the pattern of going out of Mexico is something that the Mexicans like or support, and they may not want to have that changed.
I'd just like to say about the Pastors for Peace caravan, we have regularly been harassed both crossing from the United States into Mexico on the way to Cuba and on return from Mexico into the United States. So U.S. border authorities regularly confiscated some of the aid we're taking. The Times tried to confiscate it all. They interrogate us coming back, asking, who did we see, who arranged the travel, where did we stay, who did we talk to? Of course, we refuse to answer any of those questions. We supply the information that's required on the customs declaration, which is, you know, we visited Cuba, we visited Mexico, and we have nothing to declare. Anything beyond that, we won't discuss with the border authorities. But they've threatened to sue us through the Office of Foreign Assets Control. So this has regularly happened every year I've gone, except this year, crossing the border into Mexico and coming back from Mexico and the United States, they just waved us through. In one sense, it's nice not to be hassled, but in another sense, part of our goal is to create some ruckus, and they eliminated our opportunity to do that. That is interesting, though, that I think the word got down from the administration, says, well, we don't want any incident at this time, you know, when we're reestablishing diplomatic relations with Cuba, we don't want anything that would embarrass us. But in the past, there's always been some level of harassment.
I just wanted to point out that there's certain things that have to do with the executive branch of government and certain things having to do with the legislative branch of government regarding U.S.-Cuba relations. Now, the executive branch had a few different things that they were able to do, the Obama administration this year. So they were able to release the Cuban Five. These were the prisoners who had been held all those years in U.S. prison. They also had the ability to take Cuba off of the list of most terrorist states. And also the executive branch had the ability to reestablish relations through an embassy. Now, the other two things we've been talking about, which are travel for United States citizens to Cuba and the blockade or the trade, those are both governed by legislative areas. And in that area, there's still problems. The Senate and the House of Representatives both have bills before them right now, pending, with many supporters signed on, to lift those bans. There was a special day of action in September through IFCO for citizens to request that their representatives sign on and support these measures that would lift the travel ban and lift the blockade of trade. So that's something that people could work on if they wanted to. Until those change, that's still the old repressive law that sits there and restricts travel and restricts trade.
Well, it's good to know that there are bills at least you know, have something specific to do.
Yeah. I'd also like to point out that both of our senators, Merkley and Wyden, are sponsors of the Free Trade with Cuba bill and the Freedom to Travel to Cuba bills. And our congressman, Peter DeFazio, in District 4, is also a sponsor of the House versions of those bills. There's not too much support from other congressional members from Oregon.
So, yeah, we got things to do. Thank you so much for being on KABU, Marge Stevens and Mike Beilstein.
Thanks for having us, Roberta.
Thank you.
The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Lori Childers and played by Lori Childers and Kent White.
And that concludes Monday Morning Radio Zine. We will we'll be going to the noon headlines in just a moment. And it is just a few seconds before 12 noon on KBOO. Portland. And as soon as the noon headlines are finished, we will have the noontime jamboree. So keep it right here.
Now the KABU News at noon for Monday, November 9th, 2015. In local news, the Center for Public Integrity has ranked the Oregon government as the seventh most corrupt state in the nation and gave the state government an F grade. Winner of the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Investigative Journalism, the nonprofit organization released their new study assessing each individual state government's systems they have in place that help deter corruption. Oregon was